What up? It's the Crossover Pod. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Welcome back to the Friday edition of the Crossover. Yes, we've doubled the number of episodes for the same low price of $0. You're welcome. Tuesdays, it's me and Chris Mannix breaking down all the latest from around the NBA. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Could be a player, a coach, a pundit, a musician, an actor, really anyone in or around the NBA or just a fan of the game. We kicked it off with hip-hop legends Tag Team a few weeks back. We've had comedians Sam Morril and Stav Halkias talking about their beloved Knicks. Last week, we had the NBA's scheduling czar, Evan Wash. And today, very pleased to welcome the former coach of the Atlanta Hawks, Lloyd Pierce. Lloyd, of course, was let go back in March, but I guarantee you that my fellow San Jose native will be back on an NBA bench by next season. You'll also see him as part of the coaching staff for Team USA this summer in the Olympics. Lloyd reflects on his Hawks tenure, lessons learned along the way in what was, of course, his first NBA head coaching job. We talk about just this weird season, all the challenges it's presented for teams. We talk playing, we talk MVP race, whole bunch of stuff. Really great conversation. Before we get to that, a reminder, please subscribe, rate, review the Crossover wherever you get your podcasts, and you can hit me with any feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, coming up next, my conversation with Lloyd Pierce, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, pleased to be joined by Lloyd Pierce, LP. How are you, my friend?
Good. How you doing, Howard?
I'm doing well. Before we jump into basketball, I'm, of course, morally obligated to ask, have you had any roundtable pizza recently? Have you been back to our roots back in San Jose, the Bay Area, getting the best pizza on earth, at least according to Lloyd Pierce?
I really wish I could say I have, but I have not. I am still stuck in pandemic mode, and I live in Atlanta. I stay in Atlanta, and I haven't left Atlanta. I'm actually leaving next week to go to a beach for a week and look forward to it now that we're fully vaccinated and the baby's a little bit older to try out an airplane.
Nice. Congrats again on the latest addition to the Pierce family. Of course, I hadn't even thought about this. This is yet one more minor casualty of the pandemic. You cannot get your round table pizza, but that's soon.
Big casualty.
I think as we might have covered in a previous podcast at my previous place, I grew up more as a straw hat guy. Loved round table as well, though. There was one across from my high school in San Jose, and that was our go-to spot. But we went there as much to waste all of our quarters in video games at the round table.
Right.
But the pizza was good, too. I'm not as much the aficionado as you. I got to get you when things are normal. You got to come back to New York because, as you may have heard, we have pretty good pizza here.
Not going to happen. I've been there. I've done the New York, Chicago thing, and everyone is always trying to convince you otherwise. It's round table for me. I'm good. I don't disagree with New York pizza. I'm not a deep dish guy. It's
me either.
Not my thing, but round table is my pizza.
I respect the loyalty and the devotion to the brand. It's tremendous. I hope they send you a lot of gear, and they should be shipping you pizza by now.
they did. They gave me a nice little welcome. The parent company is here in Atlanta, actually. And so when I first got the job in Atlanta in 2018, they knew of my my love for Roundtable, and they were able to bring something over for the staff and for the organization. It's pretty cool. It's pretty fun.
I will say before we leave 5 straight minutes of roundtable talk that for the younger folks who may not be familiar or just weren't alive to see these, Roundtable had phenomenal, really offbeat commercials back in the 80s.
Yeah,
go do the dive on YouTube, type Roundtable commercials. All right, enough Roundtable. it's been a couple months since the parting of ways with the Hawks. I would guess this is your longest stretch outside of daily basketball routine for quite a while in your adult life. What's the last couple months been like for you? Do you find yourself still poring over film? Are you glued to League Pass every night? What is this period like for you?
Boring, honestly. You know, you go through the range of emotions. For me, it was initial frustration and pissed off. And but I've always been a realist about everything. And, you know, the organization made a decision that's best for the organization, and they're doing extremely well. So who am I to knock them? You know, as a competitor, you'd love to be in that position. And, you know, you kind of go through the range of what a year is going to look like for you and the ups and downs. And that's just part of the job is getting through the adverse times and hopefully getting to enjoy the, you know, the roller coaster side where it really turns, and it turned for Atlanta and they're doing great. And I'm really happy for those guys. And as a coach, that's your job. Your job is to be supportive, to plant the seeds and to watch them grow and to watch the organization grow. And so I have nothing but joy for them. I'm just bored. Because as you said, after this is my 14th season, 14th season in the NBA. And, you know, to not really be a part of any team, and you're just kind of sitting around. And then on top of it, we had a baby and we're in the pandemic. So we're no longer just in a routine. We're in a routine of nothing, because I refused to really go anywhere until we got vaccinated, until we were safer, I guess you want to say. But no, it's been interesting. It's been more interesting because of the pandemic. You know, if you really go back and you look at March of last year till May of this year, and really my March when I got let go, I've only coached 2 months. When we shut down, you're out for 9 months. We weren't in the bubble. We're out for 9 months. And a lot of that was we couldn't even get into the gym. And then we couldn't do anything as a team. And then I coached from December to basically March. And so I've been out from March to May, and then I'll be out, you know, until whenever the next season starts. So it's what do you do? For me, it's not watch League Pass every night. It's hard to watch without any true agenda of scouting a team, preparing for a team, supporting a team. And so, you know, I try and pick and choose who I want to watch. It makes it interesting to watch a Charlotte team, because I really enjoy watching them play, to watch Washington because I think they're doing tremendous things right now, climbing back into the race. You know, that's my angle now, and that's how I've spent time watching and choosing games.
That's kind of cool, though, Lloyd, in some way. I mean, I know, obviously, you'd rather be plugged in and have that manic thing that coaches have where everything is examining everything down to the last detail and there's an investment in it. But on the other hand, you get to be a fan for right now. I mean, you just said, like, you really enjoy watching Charlotte. Like, this great ball movement team. LaMelo is a ton of fun. Who wouldn't love watching the Wizards every night? I mean, you get to do that. Like, is there, if that's the good side of it, who else do you like to watch? And is there a kind of basketball when you can just be a fan of the NBA instead of having to examine it to death and scouting it? Is there a type of basketball that you enjoy most as just a fan?
I'm still a coach, and so it's an opportunity to learn a little bit more about, you know, Utah's spacing on offense and how they're generating the type of threes they're generating and why they're shooting the percentages that they're shooting. I think Quinn does a tremendous job of getting the corners filled, their downhill attack. And this is in the half court, which makes it even more special. The way they can space, it doesn't matter who's in the corner. You know, Gobert, they don't just have him as a traditional post running to the block. He's playing through the elbow. He's playing in the trail spot. And he's obviously going into some pick and roll, some ball screen. So to watch it a little closer, to study it, they've been out without Donovan. They've been without Conley for a little bit. And so to see them do it at a tremendous rate, even without those guys, it really speaks to their understanding of the concept. I think in a weird way, Charlotte does it as well. They play through the elbows with any of their bigs, and their bigs can be Biombo. It could be Bridges. It could be PJ Washington. But they have enough playmakers, and they've missed their playmakers. They've missed LaMelo Ball for a while. He's now back. They missed Gordon Hayward for a while. He's still out. Devontae Graham has been out. And so, you know, just understanding how teams, especially those two, because I think Charlotte has been at the top of the league all year in assists, and obviously Utah, I think, is leading the league in three-point percentage. Just understanding the conceptual side of what they're doing. And then I've spoken to different coaches. And so, you know, when you speak to a coach, you want to follow up and watch that team and see how they're doing. And, you know, Boston's a guy, you know, I've spoken to Brad a few times and, you know, the adversity that he's faced this year with the injuries and missing guys and trying to get that thing going. I think they'll be fine in the playoffs. I think they're going to have a full roster for the first time. And then you'll see how competitive they can be. So, it's a different angle. It's a different approach, but there's no rhyme or reason as to who I'm watching. You know, you just get familiar with someone this week, and then you study them a little bit more. I enjoyed the Brooklyn and Milwaukee series the other day. It felt like an early playoff, but I know in a month or two from now, by the time they meet again, things will be different and even more intense.
I don't know how many of those two-game series you had, Lloyd, before you and the Hawks parted ways, but you mentioned, you know, it was fun watching Nets-Bucks twice in a row this week. And I think from a fan perspective, there's some advantages to that. Maybe from a league perspective, there could be some advantages to that. I don't know if that's something that would carry over. From the coaching side of it, how did you guys like or dislike this idea that you go in with that?
I thought it was great. You know, the first one we had was Brooklyn. It was, and we split Brooklyn early January. It was December 30th, I think, and January 1st or something like that. You really get to make adjustments, and you get to see if your team can handle adjustments. And you know, at that time for us with the Hawks, we lost by 4. And a game that we were really competitive early, and KD and Kyrie turned into KD and Kyrie in the fourth quarter. And we made, I thought, some subtle adjustments in the second game, and I think beat them by 18 or 16 or something along those lines. And you really get to feel the adjustments. And I think there's a belief that gets instilled from the adjustments of playing a team twice. So that was fun. And we did the same thing in preseason. We played Memphis twice. And then we ended up playing them again early, December 26th. And so that felt very similar as well, because you get to make those adjustments. And then obviously the travel portion of it, where you go and play two games, you stay there. There's a comfort of rest. And obviously we weren't going anywhere anyways because of the restrictions. But there is an element of rest that you get knowing you're going to play a team twice in the same city at over 2 or maybe 3 days.
So the league will obviously, if they're thinking about this at all, and I think they're at least considering some of the aspects of this season to maybe continue forward, at least as a thought experiment. There are marketing and sales reasons to maybe not do it. You want to, you know, a marquee team, you want them to come through twice, and, you know, maybe it dilutes it, whatever. Just from a pure competition standpoint, it sounds like you'd be all in favor of keeping that as an element of the schedule.
Yeah, you know, there's obviously some downside to it. You know, if you go and play a team twice and you're missing guys, you're going to miss them in both of those games. You know, who knows what time, especially in this season, who knows what time of year it is for someone. You know, Brooklyn loses to Milwaukee the other day, and they lose both of those games, but there's no James Harden. I'm sure it's a different story had James played and different elements. So, you know, that does add, especially a marquee game. I get, you know, rolling into New York two different times as opposed to just being there once and playing, getting both of them out of the way. Probably great from a marketing standpoint to stretch it out a little bit.
Yeah. And I think that's why they've always done it traditionally. I think they like the idea that a team comes through a city twice at different intervals. Plus, as you know, like just the rhythms of a season, you know, even if you're fully healthy, even if you've got all your players, teams are in a different state of development at different stages. And so I get it. But I do think, to the extent that the league has always been very conscious, or has in recent years been very conscious of fatigue and player health, like there's definitely some merit.
You can take, you know, and I think the better example is a guy like Anthony Edwards and a guy like LaMelo Ball. You can put them into the prime time early in the season, and they wouldn't have been as attractive. Yeah. I think people enjoy watching Anthony Edwards right now. And I think they enjoy watching LaMelo Ball right now. And so had you played both of those games, that marquee game against the Lakers or the Knicks early in the season, it wouldn't have been as attractive. Yeah. If you put it in later in the season, it's probably a big time event because people want to see the two new young guys, and they're playing a lot better as well.
So it's been a weird season, and there've been a lot of injuries, everything else. That was one of the primary themes, main themes, for the Hawks early on. And so I do want to touch on this real quick. You start off with, you know, you didn't have Rondo and Gallinari. You guys lose DeAndre Hunter. Radish have been hurt. Dunn, I think, still hasn't played. Like, all the injuries you guys go through, and, you know, coaches say this all the time, you know, we're hired to be fired. It's baked in. You understand it. But Doc Rivers said when you were let go, he says, quote, most of the rebuilds, unfortunately, go the way of Lloyd Pierce. You're in the middle of a rebuild, and then you blame the coach for the losses that you had, no chance to win. Unfortunately, that's just the way it's worked in the league. I know you got a lot of support from the coaching community at the time it happened. It's always nice to see. It's great how supportive the coaching fraternity always is in situations like this. Did you look at it the same way as Doc did? How long does it take, I guess, to just kind of like rationalize it or process it in your own mind? You know what you were dealing with at the time, and you know, but this is kind of the cold, you know, hearted part of the league, right?
I wouldn't even call it cold hearted. It is what it is. You know, yes, you do know what you're dealing with. Yes, you've seen the story a million times before. And, you know, I don't get an opportunity without someone else's failure or, you know, without someone else moving on, regardless of what the circumstance or situation is. I was doing NBA TV earlier this year, and Terry Stotts, I think, won his 500th game or whatever the number is. And in the post game, he spoke about, he said it, and it was almost like I was saying it. He said, you know, it's amazing to be here. You know, after my 2 years in Atlanta, I never thought I would even get 100 wins. And that's kind of where I'm sitting at. It's like, man, will I ever get another chance? Yeah. Because every coach has been through this, whether it's a rebuild or whether they just, you know, it just didn't work out or whatever the case may be. We've seen, I'm not the first person to be fired or let go. And, you know, the team's gone on and done well. That's happened many times before. Sometimes it's just not the right fit. Sometimes, you know, it's just not the right understanding. Sometimes it's, you know, the growth of the organization moves at one speed and you're moving at a different, and someone else is able to do it differently and better or whatever the case may be. And I get that. I think, as coaches, we all respect one another. And I think Doc's statements were to be a realist, but also to show support, because he understands the grind that we all go through as coaches, the day-to-day part. You know, are you coaching minute restrictions? Are you coaching injured players? Are you coaching transactions? Whatever the case may be, we know it. We know it more than the outside. And so he's just showing his support, but he's also saying, hey, I've been there. There's other coaches that have been there. And unfortunately, that's what we go through, but we all know it. And so for me, I've always said, and I told Travis this when he hired me, and I told him this the day he told me that we were moving a different direction. I said, I'm always going to be appreciative of the offer, because who knows if you ever get to be a head coach in this NBA league. I'm in my 14th year, and I've already been a fired head coach. To me, that's the greatest accomplishment I can tell someone. I'm a fired NBA head coach, and it's only been 14 years. And so that shows how far I've come in a short time. And, you know, I still have a long way to go in my career, so I'm fine.
And that's the thing, too. Like, you know, you mentioned Terry Stotts. I remember when George Karl was lobbying back before Terry had even gotten his first head coaching job, saying, how come no one's hiring this guy? This guy's phenomenal. And it goes like this, right? Like, guys can be an assistant and rise through the ranks and just be stuck there for in perpetuity. It's hard to break through. It's hard to get those opportunities. What was the best, whether it was just supportive outreach or advice or words of wisdom, What was the text, phone call, best thing? And then if you could identify by name, great. If not, just maybe just what the message was in the wake of it.
You know, it gets, there's two points where I've had phone explosions when I first got the job in Atlanta. And then when I got let go, where your phone just, it goes crazy. It's really hard to even explain. And I get like what the players go through. It's really hard to explain what happens to your phone for a couple of days. I'm sure there's still a lot of people I forgot, and some I intentionally didn't forget, but just didn't respond to. But no, what happens is you speak to everyone. And I probably spoke to 20 of the head coaches, and you get a different glimpse of the stories and what they've been through and what you should do. And, someone says you're going to go through the blame part, and I did. And then you're going to go through the frustration part, and I did. And you're going to go through the anger part, and then you're just going to be. And then someone told me, he said, then the calls are just going to stop. And then you're not going to be talking to anyone. And that's what it is. And I've spoken to a few GMs, assistant GMs, and personnel as well. And that's been great, because it's just the support of it's really what happens when you speak to everyone. And I think that's the best way of saying it. When you speak to everyone, you end up realizing there's nothing to be embarrassed about. And I never was embarrassed, and there's nothing to be frustrated about. When people reach out, it shows you've done some good things, and they're supportive of that, and you should be respected for that. And that's how I take it.
This was your first head coaching opportunity, as you mentioned. So as you, go through this period of kind of weighing next opportunities, you'll be part of obviously Team USA with the Olympics this summer. What do you come away with, Lloyd? Like, what do you, to the extent that this was the first opportunity to run the show yourself, is there, lessons learned that you're taking into the next gig, things that you didn't even know going into this one when you were hired a few years ago?
Yeah. The first thing is it's simple. You, if you've never been a head coach, you're not fully prepared. It's really that simple. If I get a chance, I'm going to do this. No, you're not. You don't know. You don't know what your personnel is. You don't know who you're working with. You don't know ownership and management and how you guys communicate. And so you have to take a decision and think of all of those things and incorporate all of those people. And then you have to make a decision. And so whatever you have in your mind is for you. When you become the head coach and you're in that seat, it's for the organization. It's for everyone else. And you have to factor that in. And so the decision-making part of being a head coach, I'm much better now than I was in 2018. I've made a lot of decisions, and some have been wrong. And some have been, some have been hard. Some have been easy. Some have been wrong. Some have been right. But I've made a lot of decisions, and I now have experience making decisions, and I feel really confident about that. The other thing is you're just better in terms of what you like, what's important, what's not important, what you don't like, what you can coach. And everyone says this as in that seat, the X's and O's are great. I can give you, Howard, I can sit here and go through plays and defensive schemes with you, and just kind of, I feel like I can blow your mind away. I can draw up anything. That's really not the deal. In a lot of ways, as a coach, you do too much sometimes. And I probably did too much X's and O's from time to time, and strategy and trying to do that. Really, it's simple. These players are so good. Keep it simple is really the approach. And so you start, as I reflect, you start thinking back, and all I do is say, where did I go wrong? What do I need to improve upon? I know where I'm better, and how do I make that even more of an asset for me and my coaching leadership and my style? But where did I you know, where could I have grown? Where should I have grown? What should I have spent my time doing more? Things that in 2018, I was trying to prepare and lead upward and outward. And now I have to come back and look inward and figure out, you know, what's my leadership? How do I improve upon my leadership? Because I've shown I can be a leader and I've done that and I've made the decisions. How do I do it better is my next strategy.
It's interesting the way you mentioned that, or just the X's and O's versus leadership versus, like, I always think of coaching in this league, Lloyd, as like this, it is this combination of all these things. And fans sometimes will get a little bit obsessive about the details, about, oh, who runs the best out of timeout plays and all this stuff. But I've always thought, and maybe this is just because the first beat I covered was a crazy ass but great Laker team with Shaq and Kobe. And it's, you know, Phil Jackson is there in large part, not just for the X's and O's. He's great at that too, but he was seen as a guy who managed the personalities, the egos, the expectations, all that stuff. And so, you know, there's some theoretical pie chart, I'm sure, for coaches about what amount of it in the NBA is X's and O's, what amount of it is preparation and scouting, practices, structure, organization, all these things, staff, development, all these different things we could put into that pie chart. But then there's some part of it that is just simply communication / leadership and all that, right? So, like, give people an idea, like, what is the true breakdown of what is about scheme and strategy versus what's about just simply managing people?
Well, it's all inclusive. You know, I'll give you an example. If you're watching any elite team, and, you know, Dame Lillard, Kawhi, guys, you know, at the end of the game with 7 seconds or less, 10 seconds or less, they're going to have the ball in their hands. James Harden in Houston. And so you're going to look at it. We all know that. We know where it's going before it happens. And so now when you watch the game, so does everyone else. So if you go and double team James Harden, and he doesn't touch the basketball, or he has to get off the basketball, and someone else is forced to scramble and they miss the shot and they lose, it's like, how can James not take that shot? Right? Poor coaching. Flip it around, and, you know, you say, well, why didn't they execute something better? So you're fighting the battle of, should the coach execute something better, or should that guy just have the ball? But at the same time, defensively, you know, they're just going to double team him. So we need to draw up something better, and it may not come back to him shooting it, but we have to understand what's going on. Those are the battles you go through as coaches all the time, trying to get the ball to your best player, trying to execute a play, players needing to buy into it. But more importantly, our main job is really to prepare the guys. And this is what, for me, you know, one of the faults you go back and you look at is, you know, continue to grow in areas that you think can help prepare your team. And that's the bottom line in a lot of the X's and O's of it, because the players are so good. They should be empowered. They should be able to do more. And you have to instill something that gives them organization, but also let them be empowered to play. And so preparation is important. Are you a foul up three guy? You know, if you can establish that, then they know how to execute it. And we don't have to try and do it in the flow. You know, after makes, after free throws, after timeouts, can you give them something other than that? You know, someone, and I was talking to someone the other day, and they were saying, you can watch an NBA game and you can see 12 possessions and not one play is called. That's not a knock on the league. That's an understanding that players are good enough that they know how to play out of flow, and that's how the game's going to go. You may have to tidy it back and give them something to reorganize them, but that's just how the game's going to go. And it's really understanding that. So I think going through the scenarios of how do you best prepare your players of how to play conceptually so that they can play freely is really important.
Of course, that requires practice time, which there is less and less of.
And that preparation ties into max. And that's where this is management. This is leadership. How do you manage the time? You have to do it via film. You should have a great staff that can implement it in individual workouts. And you have to maximize when you're together as a time so that you get reps and you get the main points across to the guys. And that's the challenge. And that's really, if you speak to any coach this year, forget me, you speak to any coach, that's been the greatest challenge. It's been the availability of bodies and then the lack of availability of practice, efficient practice time.
Yeah. So the compressed schedule, I'm sure people have seen that phrase way too many times, but you know, there's the toll it takes on the players, the game's coming very quickly. There's lack of practice time, which obviously, you know, can hurt teams as well. And then there was obviously just, especially in January, where all the COVID issues, postponements, guys in protocols, there's still guys in protocols now, just not in the same volume. Give me some sense from the inside LP of just how difficult this season has been, you think, for players and coaches, that it's like injuries. The league says injuries as a statistical matter are not up. There are a lot of really high profile ones. And so that has our attention, but they're saying, you know what? It's actually only, you know, one more game per month. The compressed schedule isn't that compressed. It was more compressed in the lockout season in 11-12, and the injuries aren't really up, but still I keep hearing that this feels like a more taxing season for teams. And part of that, I think, is getting up early for COVID tests and everything that goes with that. Has it been that striking of a difference?
I think so. And I think it's different. You know, I thought, especially in December and January, for the first time doing it in this fashion, I thought it was bizarre how difficult and how different it was. We would fly to a city and practice, and then that was the last time you touched the court before a game. No shoot around, couldn't go early. You're restricted in how early you could even get to the game. So, you know, for guys that do development and take the younger guys over early, you couldn't really do that. And so really you're saying you're a pro player, and the amount of volume, the games, the amount of games you play throughout the week, your last time leaving the court is probably 5 p.m. on a Tuesday. And the next time you touch a court is 8 p.m. on a Wednesday. That's different. That's really different. Guys like their rhythm. They like to get shots up, whatever the case may be. We as coaches like shoot arounds. We like to go through our stuff, our sets, our opponent sets. And so it's really different. But the flip side, the harder part was, because we couldn't do that and we were limited in everything we could do or couldn't do, really, you're basically just sitting in a hotel from the time you got back from practice at 5 or 6 o'clock until you left for the arena. And so, you know, we didn't have the full gym at the hotel to work out in. You kind of have a makeshift gym. You're stuck in your rooms. We got this big ballroom that we're meeting in and we're having dinner in, and guys are just passing each other in the morning to do their testing, which is just bizarre. And, you know, we have an afternoon film session that made it seem team bonding, because that was the time we finally got to connect. And so I think it may not be a lot of injuries, but I don't know if they consider health and safety protocols an injury. I know there was a lot of that. And that's 10 to 14 days of no conditioning or limited conditioning or different conditioning, in addition to if you're actually sick. And so the missed time and then the missed time coming back, and then just the downside of not being able to work as much. And I think you're seeing, you know, and I mentioned Washington and even Atlanta. Atlanta's playing great. Guys like Bogey, they're playing great because they're out of this, you know, they're in their mid-season form. And a lot of guys miss mid-season form because once they got going, health and safety protocols shut them down for 2 weeks. And then soft tissue injuries shut them down for a couple days. And so it takes time to recover. And there's a lot of guys, and Washington has been probably the biggest one team this year. I remember texting with Scotty after we played him early in the year, and he said, it's been 25 days since we've been able to practice as a full team. Because they had a bunch of guys out at the same time in early January or February. And I'm sitting here saying I'm complaining about missing a couple guys. He has no one. He has no one. They can't even get on the court. So, you know, no woe is me on my part. And there's still no woe is me. It's just one of those years.
I think I actually neglected to mention Bogdanovich when I was listing all of your injuries early in the season. But yeah, the Wizards had 2 weeks just like wiped off the schedule. No games, no practices, anything. They just didn't even have bodies. I mean, that's unheard of. Like that in no other NBA season in NBA history has a team just in the middle of a season been like, okay, no practices, no games. We won't even see each other for 2 weeks. Right. I think this season in many ways is actually the more unusual. Like last year, okay, there was a 3-month shutdown. There's a bubble where 8 teams aren't even invited. And yes, everything is strange. But from start to finish, I mean, yeah, okay, this season is 72 consecutive-ish games. But considering all that we just discussed, like this is actually the more unusual of the two seasons in a lot of ways, or maybe the more challenging.
I think it is. I really do. And I think everyone will be excited when it's over for different reasons, for very different reasons. I think everyone will. But I think this is, you know, the bubble, there weren't many cases. There weren't many guys having to sit out once they started. Yeah. This one, you know, and you look at the Chicago situation and they get this great trade and they bring in Vucevic and they're ready to make this final push. And then Zach goes down for 3 weeks, two to three weeks. And so I think for everyone, it's going to be a unique time that when it's all said and done with, it's like, wow, I can't believe that's how we played a year. And, you know, the teams that are in it this year are trying to make the most of it. And some have, and some have really just, they're probably like, you know, enough's enough. Let's just move on.
Yeah. Play-in tournament, pro or con?
For this year,
yeah.
Pro,
yeah,
definitely. For all the reasons I listed, you know, it's unfair to say, you know, a team doesn't deserve an opportunity with all of the adversity they had to go through. If they're close enough and the tournament is in play for that, it makes sense. Moving forward, I know it generates additional interest. I'm not a big fan. I think if you're a 7 seed, and because I think there's going to be some unintended consequences. You're the 7 seed and there's a team that's 8 games back or 6 games back in the 10th seed and they just need to win 2 games to surpass you. And you miss 2 or 3 guys heading into the playoffs and all of a sudden you got to fight for your life. I think that's an indictment on, you know, that 82 game schedule you just played. Mm-hmm. And so, I think it makes tremendous sense for this year because of the weird way it just put a lot of teams in different spots and it gives them an opportunity to at least get back and compete. But I don't know if I would like this for 82 games moving forward the way it is. Maybe there's a different way of doing it, but I don't know if I agree that the 7 seed is going to lose a chance to the 10th seed who's 8 games back.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like if I were one of those teams or a fan of one of those teams that was in that 7-8 range, I would feel I would not be happy about it if they got knocked out in a play-in tournament, for sure, after an 82-game season. On the other hand, as a reporter and as just a fan of the game, like I love the fact that all these teams are still engaged and their fan bases are – like New Orleans is still in this thing somehow and with a week to go, and they've had a rough season. Like interest-wise, excitement-wise, like they, like that's a definite plus.
Well, think about it. You know, a few years ago, I felt as if there was a push for, well, let's just take the top 16 teams, regardless of conference,
yes,
and put them in and then seed them that way, because you're rewarding the top 16 teams. And there was an argument for that, but it still came down to East versus West. Yeah. And that was the big pushback. Now we're not saying that. We're saying, well, let's just give more teams an opportunity. They may not deserve it, but so I kind of get the top teams because they deserve it. And, you know, a top team may be punished because they're just in the wrong conference.
Yeah.
Now we're saying a team probably doesn't deserve it, but the rules kind of allow for them to have an opportunity. And that, you know, as a competitor, that doesn't sit very well.
Yeah. Maybe what we need going forward is this, some modified version of what they're doing this year. So maybe the 7th seed locks in also. Maybe it's only 8th that has to be in the play-in or something like that. I do like the fact, Lloyd, that just we've got the 12th or 13th place teams still competing. I don't necessarily want to have
that.
right?
Right.
Like it's a great anti-tanking measure. It's a great inducement to have the last weeks of the season mean something for most of the league. If nothing else, it's a
compliment. And that's why I think for this year, there's a lot of advantage to it, and you're getting the 11th and the 12th teams continuing to compete at a high level. And I think that's what we always want, is we want everyone to compete from start to finish and not just throw in the towel at any point. But it's going to be hard for me to wrap my head around that moving forward after this year.
I'm sure you're not the only one. It'll be an interesting debate. You were with the Sixers for 4 years. You were up
Hi.
5 years, excuse me. My math sucks. Up close and personal with Joel Embiid that whole time. What have you seen from a distance different in the way he's elevated his game this season? And where should he be on my MVP ballot?
maturity is the biggest thing. Joe called me in I believe it's early August, mid-August, somewhere in that point, and he had just had his son, Arthur. And I'm sitting there looking at Joel Embiid sitting in a nursery with his son, and I just started laughing. He FaceTimed me. I just started laughing. I said, man, you've come a long way. And so when you watch him on the court, you see he's come a long way. He knows who he is completely, and he knows how to be confident. He knows how to be strategic, and he knows how to be dominant. And I think we're all seeing all of that. And he's being smart. You know, I think he's an MVP candidate. I would have, you know, out of bias, I would have been choosing him all year to see him earn the reward. Award, and really I think he's deserving of it, but naturally he's missed a lot of games, and that makes it hard when you have a candidate that hasn't and has been good, equally as good from start to finish. And I think that guy is Jokic, but I wanted Joe to win it. I think he's been dominant. I think he's had a tremendous year from start to finish, but you know, you have to, I think you have to reward the award based on this season and this season alone, and you do it from start to finish, and who's been, and that's how I look at it. And I think Jokic has been tremendous from start to finish, and there's a lot of guys that were considered and should have been considered, and I was rooting for Joe, but I think it's Jokic.
Yeah, I think that's where my head is as well. And it's, you know, people have started to push back on the games played thing and said, well, you can't punish a guy for just, it's not his fault. Like, it's not about punishing anybody. It's about the idea that when we assess valuable, being available and playing more games and more minutes is valuable. And it's a pretty big gap in games, and it's an even more massive gap in minutes. And like, that matters too. Like, being great for as long as possible in as many minutes of the season as possible, that's part of value. I feel like it's baked in.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways that you look at what value brings and what value means to this award. Obviously my old teammate Nash won it years ago, and I remember him winning, and I remember the argument that when he was out for a few games, they were not very good, and that was the value in him winning it. It's like, that's how valuable he is. And so, you know, for Jokic, I think one of the things you look at when Jamal Murray gets hurt, they go 9-1, I think, before they lose.
Incredible.
And that's value. That's value. Yes. And so it's you have to figure out what you think is the, you know, how do you determine the award? And that's how I look at it. It's from start to finish in this season and this season only. Who's most deserving of the award? And I think Chris Paul should be in there. I think he's done a tremendous job with that team and his impact.
I love what Chris Paul has done, and this is such a difficult season for MVP, because we've got the guys with the dominant stats: Jokic, Embiid, Giannis, Kawhi, even, and then you've got what Lillard and Curry have done to elevate teams that, you know, otherwise would just be utterly lost. And then what Chris Paul is doing for the Suns is incredible. And the stats aren't there. He's you know, people have analogized, I think accurately on some level, to Steve Nash's MVP years, where he didn't have the eye-popping stats. You just knew what his impact was on those Suns teams. I don't know how to get, like, I'm not sure if Chris will be on my ballot at the end, only because there's too many great candidates. And I've been arguing for my new campaign is we need a bigger MVP ballot. We got to go like 7, 8, like in baseball, they go 10 deep on the MVP ballot. And that way you can have both the guys who have the traditional case, dominant season, and their team is one of the best in the league. And then you can also still find a way to reward, you know, a season like Lillard's had or Curry. Chris Paul would be in there for sure if it's a bigger ballot. I don't know. I know what my 1 and 2 is. The 3 through right. 5 is going to cause me to lose sleep.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think you have guys that are worthy of being in the MVP conversation that may also not make the first team All NBA team.
Yeah. Yeah. Also because it's by position.
By position. And so Joel and Jokic
can't both be on there.
You know, how are they going to do that? And, you know, who are your two top guards for first team All NBA and even second team All NBA? So it's fun. It's fun to have those conversations. They're never easy. It's great that we're having the amount of high level talent play at high level this season, despite all of the adversity that has come with this season.
A couple more before I let you go. You mentioned adversity. We were just talking about your old college teammate, Steve Nash. So the Nets big three have been together for 7 games, 186 minutes. I think every NBA pundit and every NBA fan now knows those two stats. 7 games, 186 minutes. I am a big believer after covering this league for 24 years that all these things that we talk about every year, LP, chemistry, rhythm, practice time, training camps, all these things that we talk about it being important to teams and team development and guys being able to read each other and having, you know, going through duress and situations or whatever, that all has to mean something. And so this idea that the Nets can just get everybody healthy, roll them out for the playoffs, and they'll be fine and win a championship, I don't know that that makes sense to me. It's not because I don't want to see it happen. They're a phenomenal team, fabulous talent, but it seems like that would just obliterate every bit of conventional wisdom we ever thought existed about chemistry and the need for guys to play together. Is it possible? Where do you think the Nets are headed with a team that has barely played together?
Yeah, I think it's very much possible that they can still pull it off. Yes, those three have not played tremendous minutes together, but James has been there and he's played with a lot of those other guys without KD. KD has been there and he's played with a lot of those other guys without James. Kyrie has been there and they've played with each other. They've played with their teammates and they have a feel for their teammates. So I think it's very much possible to have those three on the floor. I think there's a willingness that all three have shown throughout this year to take the backseat and also be featured. They've shown that they're willing to do it. They just haven't done it. But more importantly, they've had chemistry with the rest of that roster. The rest of that roster is equally as important, if not more, for what it's going to take moving forward to win. They have to be really tough defensively. They have to be more physical defensively. They have to win the 50-50 battles and games. They have to get some of those effort plays. That's going to be a requirement by all of them. The luxury they're going to have is if they do have the big three, that's hard to guard. And so it's not an indictment to say, hey, those three have not played together a lot. They actually have in the past in different scenarios, but their willingness is, I think, at a high level for three guys who came together in this season because of their previous experience. But if you put all three of those guys on the floor and they're healthy, it's more than a possibility of them being able to win it. It's going to come down to the other stuff, and they all have experience with the other guys of getting that other stuff down, the 50-50 plays, the defensive stops, the versatility in their lineups. Can KD play at the five with some different lineups? You know, Nash has had the luxury, and you don't really get to talk about this much because he doesn't have all of those guys. He's had the luxury to mix up lineups. And that's what they're going to end up doing in the playoffs is play a lot of different lineups and lineups that teams can't prepare for because they hadn't seen it. And so, you know, there are some things that I think he's getting to do without having all three. And then there's some things I think the three of those guys are going to bring that people aren't really looking at. And I think that willingness to play off the basketball, on the basketball, and, you know, watch each other shine as well. I think they have that. I think I saw glimpses of that in them when they did play, and I can see how they interact with each other as well.
It just would be, so I think it would be completely unprecedented. Like, there's never been, a team has never just been put together like that with a guy coming in, you know, a month into the season, and then their three best players not playing together hardly at all. Like, there's no template for this whatsoever, which is not to say it couldn't happen, but it would be wild.
And so so the flip side is, well, which team has been consistent all year that is better?
Well, okay, but the Bucks and Sixers cores have at least been together longer. There's a continuity that dates back before this season, right? Like, those, like, I, you know, Drew and PJ Tucker are new to the Bucks.
Drew and PJ are two new guys that are instrumental moving forward, but it's still not a large body. You know, Lakers have Andre Drummond, who's now a big part of it, and Dennis Schroeder wasn't with them, so they're still relatively new because of how much time Anthony Davis and LeBron missed.
Sure.
And so you go down and you look at it, and it's kind of the same. It's just not as hyperbolic or exaggerated as the Brooklyn scenario.
Yeah. I just think that getting out of the East alone, like, if the Sixers and Bucks weren't as strong as they already were anyway and had the continuity of their core groups from previous years, then I'd say the Nets would have an easier path despite not having their big three play together much. But those are legit teams. So I'm sure you've got, you know, conflicting loyalties there between your time with the Sixers and Embiid, right, those guys, versus your longtime friendship with Nash in Brooklyn. So I'm not going to ask you to pick a favorite unless you want to.
here's the other thing, and I'll add to that, is one of those teams is going to escape until the final round.
Yeah.
Two of them are going to have to face each other in the second round. By the time you get to the final round, how many minutes will those three have logged?
Sure. Assuming they're healthy.
Right?
Yeah.
It could be about, you know, anywhere from 6 to 14 games, whatever, 8 to 14 games, whatever it may be, where they now do have great chemistry and they played well together. I don't know.
Yeah.
But and the flip side, someone could get hurt on another team, and now you don't have your core together. And that's why I say it's possible. It's more than possible. It really requires a willingness.
Yeah.
And then availability, obviously, in the playoffs is for everyone.
That's the theme of this season, I guess, LP. Anything is possible, good, bad, or otherwise, weird, offbeat, unprecedented. Things are on the table,
right,
in a season like this one. Well, this has been great, man. I appreciate you spending some time. Thank you. I know you've got the little ones at home to get to. I could see somebody wandering around back there behind the glass doors. I will let you get back to being a dad. Enjoy your beach time coming up, and I hope you get a round table soon.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Howard.